Greetings, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the net control operator tonight for the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going on since 1982, and archives are available at amateurradio.tv. I'll be running things tonight. I would like to mention a few little things that I usually mention at the top of my little talk. If you have any email questions, if you have any topics or technical questions and you can't get onto the net, or if you have anything that you want me to pass on to Paul, you can send it to mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Anything that I talk about, any stories and such, we'll have links available, and I've put some new links onto my page, and that page is roy.ac2gs.com. So if you're interested in further material or interested in YouTube, you can check it out at roy.ac2gs.com. Chat room. You can get to there by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And you can tell people that if they don't have a radio or they can't get the repeater either on radio or on Echolink, that I stream it via the internet at technet.ac2gs.com. So those are things that I like to keep people aware of. And let me drop, and I'll ask if anyone would like to check in for any questions or topics tonight of a technical nature. Okay-doke. Anyone out there with a question or a topic for discussion tonight, you know, just technical. We'll save the virus talk until a little bit later on. My sense is that go through the TechNet portion, and then I'll do a couple of stories that are appropriate and topical for the virus, or for any questions that anyone might have. But right now, for this first segment, is there anyone who'd like to check in for any questions or topics? Oh, okay, Brandon, you're breaking up for some reason. Okay, I don't know what's going on, but you're dropping packets. I can't even say what percentage of the comments that you made went across. It was very little, so I don't know if the microphone's a little bit iffy or packet loss is the problem, but you're experiencing some problems with Echolink there.
Okay, yeah, I'm on my cell phone now. Hopefully that's better. It might be my Wi-Fi connection, but hopefully it works now. I don't know.
Yeah, Brandon, that works perfectly. No problem at all. Let me just ask if anyone else wants to be put on the list, and then we'll get back to you, okay? Okay, I'm leaving Brandon some time because Echolink doesn't really do well with fast keying. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight for any technical questions or topics? Please give me your first name and your call sign.
Well, I'll say hello. WHCDL for anybody who has a troubleshooting problem. that maybe, or hopefully, I could help solve. Back to you, Lloyd.
Okay, very good. So welcome aboard, Andy. Andy WA2CDL knows his way around the soldering iron and calibration tools and all kinds of fun stuff. And thankfully, he'll be with us in case anyone has any repair questions. Once again, anyone out there want to put their name on the list tonight?
WA2CDL, AC2GS, this is WB2GXM. Just saying hello and wishing you all guys well. Hope everything is good.
W2JWG, just saying hello, Jim.
Zulu Rich, just saying hello.
Kilo Delta 2, Tango Lima Kilo. Roy, glad to do it again. No comments from Scott, but enjoy listening and learning from you guys. Thank you.
To Brandon, maybe after Brandon there'll be other people who have a question. Brandon, what's your question tonight?
Well, you had a check-in from a new ham. This is WS2N.
Okay, who's the new ham? I guess I talked over him or something.
This is Roy, KD2TLK, Kilo Delta 2, Tango Lima Kilo. No specific question, but since I am new, I enjoy listening and learning from you guys, so thank you.
Okay, very good. Your first name is Roy as well?
Yes, it is.
Well, that's great. There's very few Roys out there. Me and you, I guess. There's loads of Andes. There's an incredible number of Riches. But very few Roys out there. So I wish you good luck in the hobby. It is a incredible hobby. You can take of it what you wish. It has a breadth and depth that is quite unique. So I wish you good luck with your license and your new hobby.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Roy. Appreciate that. I'm having a blast so far.
Okay, doke. Back to Brandon, KB1THM on Echolink. What's your question tonight, Brandon?
Thanks for taking my question. I appreciate it. And good evening to everybody on the net. This is Brandon, KB1THM. So, my question is pertaining to digital modes, and I was doing over the weekend about cell phones, and I was reading about a mode that uses something called cross-polar discrimination, and I was wondering how this, I was just having a hard time understanding how this might work. But essentially, what they're saying is that you can send two streams of data over one frequency channel, and the way it does that is by sending one stream of data in, say, vertical polarization and the other in horizontal. And then somehow, I guess, when it gets to the device, it can discriminate between the two. And I was just curious how this is possible. It seemed it just seems hard to do with something like a cell phone that you're always tilting and, turning it from vertical to horizontal. I was wondering if anyone knew anything about this. Thanks.
Okay, Brandon, that's a real esoteric one. That's primarily, as you mentioned, cell phone technology. There is a corollary in satellite technology where two satellites will transmit to the same receiver in circular polarization, clockwise and counterclockwise. And there'll be two discriminators that are oriented either way, and there'll be a switch that switches back and forth between those two. This is, to me, a little bit even more esoteric. I mean, I'll throw it out and ask people if they are up on their orthogonal cross-polar components and such. Anyone out there who knows about this particular technology? Okay, we're sort of afraid of that. My understanding is that it's used in MIMO type of antennas, the multiple antenna modes that wireless and cell phone are concerned. My guess is, and this is purely a guess, that there's more than one antenna element kind of stuck in those type of cell phones, so that they're probably at right angles to each other, and so can do that magic of knowing the different orientations. But again, this is kind of the bleeding edge of technology. Unfortunately, us hams don't even use the simple MIMO technology that Wi-Fi devices regularly use.
Yeah, Roy, that is true. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I had never even heard of it, and I was doing some reading about another mode called QAM, where I guess you can send two streams of data out of phase from each other. But then I guess on top of that, you could even effectively double the bandwidth and send one in one polarization and another stream in another. I don't know. I just thought it was pretty cool. But thanks for the insight. I'll definitely some more reading on this, as I don't know, I just thought it was fascinating. Back to you, Roy.
Well, as will I, because I always like to learn new stuff. You were talking about quadrature amplitude modulation. That's QAM. That's a very common mode in cell phones, and there are different types of quadrature amplitude modulation. It has to do with phase differentials and such, and it squeezes more data and is a more efficient means of transmitting. There are some limitations to all things by physics alone, but QAM is one of those things that have been used for cell phones for a while now. Kind of esoteric. For one reason or another, amateur radio operators, to my knowledge, don't really use QAM or the other more esoteric modulation schemes. We're still kind of stuck at phase shift keying and such, which is kind of simple to do and simple to understand. But if you learn something interesting about it, please feel free to come back in and share it with us.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
All right, quick internet check. So they use cross-polarization to handle challenging environments. So what happens is the cross-polarized signals are isolated from each other by at least 20 dB. So in a sense, let's say you have a transmitter and a receiver. The receiver is sampling both, and they're independent. So that, let's say, you have reflection interference or something like that, you might have it on the one path but not the other. So it looks at both paths, and the reliability is increased using that technology. So if you had a phone, it wouldn't really matter if you're moving the phone around or not. The point is that you have two independent channels, you can think of it that way, which are both looked at, And looking at both of them, I guess statistically you can do some kind of error correction or whatever and have a more robust system.
Okay, thanks, Lou. So it's sort of a digital version of diversity reception. I have a setup where I have a horizontal and a vertical antenna, and I pipe one in my left ear and one in my right. This is going through some digital magic to clean it up and choose the optimum orientation for the antenna, I guess.
Yeah, and in fact, some of the diversity routers and stuff I just read, they're also, they'll have a vertical and a horizontally phased element to affect the same thing. Now, if you had a static position, then you virtually can split the channels and have different information on each channel. But typically, if it's not a fix, like if it's on your cell phone, they're using it for the same information, but just to increase reliability.
AC2GS. Okay, that makes sense to me. And as I mentioned before, I was I knew about the satellite dishes using clockwise and counterclockwise polarized, circular polarized transmissions from satellites. So I was trying to see where the two had something in common. So this is not as much of increasing channels the way, say, DMR does it with time slots. This is more of an error correction mode.
That's right. Now, in the case of the satellites, you are doing two different channels. So you had two adjacent channels on the satellite. So you had odd and even, or vertical and horizontal, and that was again to bring down the level of the adjacent channel. So if you're looking at channel one, let's say it was horizontal, and channel two is vertical, you're going to get that, you know, 20 or so dB drop, and that'll, you know, that allows them to squeeze more channels in a given frequency space.
Were they ever actually vertical and horizontally polarized? I got the impression that it was primarily a circular polarization scheme where one transponder was going clockwise and the other one was going counterclockwise, and there was usually some switching mode in your antenna that could switch off between the two.
I used to own a satellite receiver. I had it like an 11-foot dish, and if you looked at the feed horn and you looked inside of it and you switched, there was a little antenna, the focal point, where all that, you know, reflection from the parabolic dish would focus the energy on. And as you switched from even to odd channels, this maybe 1-inch piece of wire would be horizontal, then on the next channel would go vertical and horizontal again. It had a little servo in it. So that's how they worked on C-band, 3.7 to 4.2 gigahertz. What you're describing probably exists also, but on that particular system, they actually physically changed the orientation of the little antenna inside the feed horn.
Okay, that's interesting. I never really looked into those enormous satellite dishes. You know, almost everyone who lives in a residential area back in those days had some neighbor, you know, who had one of those enormous things sitting in their front lawn. And it was amazing. I mean, back in those days, that was before they encrypted the transmissions, because very relatively few people had their own enormous satellite dish. And so they were able to pull down the actual feed that the broadcast companies would get, and you could see what the guys working at the news did during the commercials and all kinds of fun stuff back then.
NY2H, yeah, some of it was fun, some of it wasn't. I witnessed, there was a politician who got in trouble in Pennsylvania. And he actually committed suicide. He shot himself, put the pistol in his mouth, and Unfortunately, I saw the whole thing unedited. But yeah, you'd see some fun stuff too, and you know, like Larry King was a good show. You'd watch that, and they'd break the commercial, and then but Larry King would be discussing offline with his hosts all sorts of stuff, and you'd be privy to that. So there's a lot of that, and it was an interesting time. Yep, that's before they started scrambling everything. So that was, and you could also they did a lot of other stuff on those satellites, not just TV channels. So if you took the RF out of it, you fed it into an HF receiver, the IF rather. They actually had subband channels. They had all the baseball channels for all the different states and everything. So there's quite a bit there. You even heard some telephone traffic and things like that.
DB apart. And in case anyone's interested, the place I found this was on CommScope's website. They have all these free lessons you can take. I think it's called the Infrastructure Academy, and it's fascinating. The quality of the online lessons is just incredible. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, unfortunately, Brandon, you kind of doubled partially with Lou NY2H. I got the second half of what you said. Infrastructure Academy, that sounds interesting. There's a lot of actually interesting websites. I'd be interested to know if this is a freebie or if this is a pay type of a facility. I know there's places like brilliant.org that offer kind of two channels. They give you stuff for free, but if you want the deluxe kind of teaching experience, you have to pay. So with Infrastructure Academy, is that free? Is it does it cost, or are there kind of two tracks? Brandon fell off the echo link, so hopefully he'll reconnect and we'll continue that. Oh, he popped back on, so I will stop for a moment and give Brandon a chance to reply.
Yeah, okay, sorry about that, Roy. Yeah, so the website, it's actually on CommScope's website. It is all free. It's called CommScope Infrastructure Academy, and the lessons are just phenomenal. It's mind-blowing that it's even free, but the first one I was doing was, it was called Microwave Link Fundamentals, and then the other one was I think it was just called RF Fundamentals, but it was absolutely mind-blowing, the quality of the lessons. Back to you.
Okay, very good. After I'm done tonight, I'll look it up, and I'll post the link on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, and share it with the rest of the people out there. I mean, you could just Google it yourself, preferably after the technical mets. But thanks, Brandon, for that recommendation. There is such an incredible amount of useful free information on the Internet that, you know, you have to kind of develop your own internal librarian to be able to search out the material. I mean, it's easy enough to just type it into Google, but you got to get a feel for what kind of keywords to use and how to recognize a less than accurate website and such. So, very good, Brandon. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Roy, thank you. I'll send it back to you and go to the next person. Thanks, guys.
Okay, very good. So, is there anyone else out there with any questions or topics tonight, technical in nature? We could talk about hotspots or software-defined radios or even computers if you want. We'll touch anything that's technological.
WB2BXO here, Roy.
Yes, Frank.
Thank you, Roy, and please excuse the delay. If somebody keeps the repeater, Echo Link doesn't keep. In any case, Roy, I saw a very interesting story on the one of the ARRL podcasts, Eclectic Tech. So, even though it's sort of in your bailiwick being medical, I guess if the ARRL talked about it, it's kind of related to ham radio also, because the guy involved was a ham. And that apparently a ham is involved in developing the electronics and antennas for a clinical trial using 915 megahertz RF to break down the protein plaques that cause Alzheimer's. And in the initial very small clinical trial with 8 patients, according to the podcast, 7 of them showed an improvement of something like a year in cognition. I was wondering if you had heard that podcast and, you know, what you think of this one. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, Frank. Well, I've heard of the podcast. I mean, I'm terribly sad that the doctor is in. Was a really nice podcast. It lasted for about 4 years, and the gentleman who did it, I think, has had some health issues because they started to rerun old versions and do other things, and then in December they just let it go after 4 years. So I kind of missed that, but I realized that the ARRL has 2 different podcasts. I don't remember the name of the other one, but I do recall the Eclectic Technology, Eclectic Tech, I think is what they call it. This is a study that's probably been around for a while, because I remember reporting on it a little bit less than a year ago. It was a guy who was making these little hats with antennas and producing RF around their head with the idea, as you mentioned, of disrupting the protein deposits that Alzheimer's patients have. The problem is, and I may address it later on when we get into COVID-19, is that early studies tend to not be terribly good for a whole bunch of reasons. They don't randomize, they don't have a large sampling size, they don't double-blind anything, and so it's very difficult to judge whether you're really getting anything or you're getting anecdotal and placebo effect. I hope it works. It doesn't really sound to me like it's that obvious to work, because it's not like these protein sheets are going to melt in your brain and not melt anything else, so the amount of heat generated probably isn't a great deal. But, you know, I mean, I'm always for research. They probably need to try it on a much larger group. They should really try it on people where half of them just put the hat on and the machine makes a noise but doesn't do anything, so you have a double blind type of situation. So you get out of that little placebo effect. But, you know, it's interesting. I wouldn't invest any money right now on that. There are a lot of other things that are being tried as far as Alzheimer's. Unfortunately, vitamin companies have kind of jumped on the bandwagon. We also talked about that a year ago, that they're pushing supplements for brain activity. And they have really nothing to show for it. Matter of fact, if you squint and you read the tiny little bottom of the part...
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I'm getting...
As they used to say on the booklet repeaters. I guess the lead that some people are encouraged is that 7 out of 8 of the patients made a dramatic improvement. But and I believe what was said on the Eclectic Tech podcast, and it was probably the most recent one if you want to check it out, what they said is the next study is going to be with about 150 patients. So I don't know if that's going to be a truly randomized, double-blind study. No, but...
Yeah, Frank, I have it on my little podcaster device, so it's on the queue to be listened to. I still think that this is the same study that was a year ago, so they're kind of delayed, or they just... decided to bring it up because of the subject matter, and I look forward to seeing what the larger numbers are. The problem is that a lot of people do tests that aren't terribly useful in the long run. They leave out things. It tends to be kind of half-backsided because, you know, it takes a lot of time and effort and money to set up a really significant study. So you sort of get together a couple of people randomly and sort of do something and just try it out at first. I mean, I'll give you the story that I was going to mention with the COVID-19. There was a study about chloroquine, the malaria medication, whether it was effective. And in France, they set up this interesting study. It had very few people. I think it had something like 35 people, so it was statistically not significant anyway. And it wasn't randomized, so some people were sicker than other people, misnumbered in the two groups. One group they gave chloroquine to, the other they didn't give chloroquine to. And initially they found that there was better surviving in the group that that was taking the hydrochloroquine. So that's a good sign, even though it's not randomized and it's not statistically significant, which is a big problem. Let me drop for a sec. But some clever guy kind of looked at the data and found out there was a little problem with it. It was an incomplete study because what had happened is the group that was in the experiment, there were people who were dropped off of the experiment. And the reason that he found out they were dropped off of the experiment was because they had been transferred off of the floor where the guy was doing this experiment onto the intensive care unit, which would kind of indicate that they were going through a very difficult time. And sure enough, some of them passed away in the intensive care unit. When the guy kind of correlated all the numbers of the people tested and reported on and the people tested and lost the follow-up because they had gotten sicker, he found the exact opposite. There were more people dying who had happened to take the chloroquine than who had not taken it. Again, it's not statistically significant, and it wasn't randomized, so it doesn't really tell you anything, but it if anything, it tells you that how you do the experiment, how you set it up, and how you let it run out can color the results dramatically. And there are many cases, especially in medicine, where there are a lot of these studies with small groups where years later they do them with large groups and double-blind and randomized and find that there's no benefit at all. So you got to watch out these studies. Some studies are wonderful, and some studies are worthless. Again, I hope that they go on to study this more because we can really use something to treat Alzheimer's, and the RF is as good as anything.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
I posted in the chat room a link to, I guess it's the... National Institute of Health. Somebody submitted a manuscript. This is on the mouse model of Alzheimer's. You know, they bred knockout gene or something where they get these mice and they give them Alzheimer's. And they did RF ablation on them. So there's a little write-up on that when you get a chance. The link is in the chat room.
Okay, very good. I'll look into that. When you say RF ablation, that usually means a different thing. That means putting a probe in there and just arcing some RF. I assume that isn't what they did, it mirrors what Frank was talking about, where they basically put a little helmet with a bunch of small UHF antennas and just generate a lot of RF around the guy's head.
NY2H. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just looking quickly. I'm not sure. It's called CRFR1 ablation.
Okay, very good. I pulled it up. It's a rather long article, and so if there's some kind of strange pause, I'll try and kind of read through it quickly. Again, would be great. I mean, these are basically what happens when protein debris tends to stack up on each other between nerves in the brain. It tends to kind of clog everything. And so if there's some mechanism to kind of accelerate the destruction and removal of these amyloid compounds, that would be fantastic. I'll have to read that.
The way the ham on the Eclectic Tech podcast described the original mouse study is, he said they put antennas near the mice who were bred with Alzheimer's, and that their performance on mazes improved over some period of time. So I'm wondering if you're looking at the same study, because like you said, the ablation study sounds like something different.
Yeah, I think it's a problem with the guy's wording. It's not really RF ablation. It's the gene ablation that causes the mice to have the pseudo senility that they're talking about. But I'm just judging it on just scanning it very quickly. So I don't think it's RF ablation. The way they call it is CRFR1 ablation, which is the genetic sequence that they screw around with the mouse to get them to develop the Alzheimer's-like syndrome.
Yeah, okay. You know, this is not something I really know anything about. I, you know, raise the question to you because I know you're kind of the expert on this stuff. What you do, by the way, as you know, providing all of real factual information, by the way, is incredibly important. I think you know that, because there are some crazy conspiracy theories going around. My nephew tweeted this morning that the bodega owner near where he is in Brooklyn is convinced that 5G cell phone towers are causing all this. You know, that's just what we need, is more conspiracy theorists. Excuse me, blaming cell phones. You know, we don't need that kind of nonsense going around in Brooklyn or anywhere else.
I agree with you, Frank. Unfortunately, when people get scared and panicky, they don't particularly get terribly rational. So this is kind of an old trope. So I'm not at all surprised that they would pull it out of a hat. Where they would draw the conclusion, it's not like Wuhan is the center of cell phone activity. I mean, cell phone activity happens all over the world, and I guess if you want to really twist and turn, you could say that, you know, maybe there was a cell tower next to the wet market where the wild animals, previous version of coronavirus mutated into one that could attack human beings, but that's a real stretch. But yeah, I always think that informed population is far better than an uninformed population because they inherently make stuff up if they're not given the right information. Unfortunately, with some people, even if you give them the right information, they make stuff up, but you can't help that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, conspiracy theories spread like wildfire on YouTube and elsewhere on the internet. When years ago, there were always these conspiracy theorists running around writing books and making speeches, but they didn't get a mass audience on YouTube, and they weren't yet, and they weren't led by the President of the United States either. Anyway, I guess I'll yield to somebody else, maybe somebody with a real ham radio-related question. Thanks a lot, Roy. WB2BXL.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it's not RF ablation. And this is what happens when you do a Google search and you put in words like RF ablation and Alzheimer's, a mouse model, word salad, let's say, and, quick and dirty. No, it's not RF ablation at all. You're right, it's the knocking out of a mechanism. So, I will be more careful in the future.
AC2GF, you are totally forgiven, Lou. You're doing this in real time, as I'm doing this in real time, and it's very difficult to pat your head and rub your stomach at the same time here as well. So I commiserate with you.
All righty. I'm waiting for Corona time.
It'll probably be coming any second now. I just want to add my two cents about paranoia. The problem with human cognitive function is we really do not like chaos. It really unsettles us. If you tell someone that just random mutations sometimes cause animal viruses to become able to infect human beings, it unsettles people to the point where they have to find a logical reason for it happening and not sheer chaos. And so you build these Tower of Babel stories of conspiracies upon conspiracies upon conspiracies, so that it might be a terrible world you're building, but at least it's a world you can rely on of having good guys and bad guys and not randomness that's in the universe being able to smack us silly. So, unfortunately, a lot of things in the universe are chaotic. Quantum mechanics is inherently a probabilistic field of science. Things happen probabilistically. They don't happen. A doesn't go to B, goes to C all the time. There's a lot of chaos out there, and you have to learn to accept it and deal with it as best you can. So that's my two cents worth on paranoia. Anyone with any questions of a technical nature before we move on to the virus net? Okay, the public has spoken, or more accurately, the public has not spoken. Let me give you a couple stories, and at the end of each story, I'll pause, and if you want to ask anything specific for those stories, you're free to. General questions about the virus, I'd like people to try and hold until I give the usual statistics, unfortunately, of the numbers going up. Then we can talk about it as long as you'd like up to the Paul Space Report. So let me drop, and I will give you my first little story that has to do with the coronavirus. Okay, medical device maker Abbott has received emergency authorization from the United States Food and Drug Administration for its new molecular point-of-care COVID-19 test, which will allow healthcare providers in a variety of different settings to obtain results almost immediately. The new test can deliver positive results in as little as 5 minutes and negative results in 13 minutes. In an announcement published on Friday, Abbott said that the test would be used in physicians' offices, urgent care clinics, and hospital emergency departments. It will run on the company's ID Now platform, a portable device the size of a small toaster that is already used to detect influenza A and B, strep A, and respiratory syncytial virus. Abbott said it was ramping up production and that it was hoping to deliver 50,000 tests per day to the U.S. healthcare system beginning next week. Per Bloomberg, Abbott ID Now platform is the most commonly used point-of-care platform in the United States, with more than 18,000 units located across the country. To obtain results, Abbott's molecular test uses a chemical solution to, quote, crack open the virus, end quote, which releases its general genetic material for the ID Now system to read. If there is even a small amount of COVID-19 in that sample provided, the company explains the ID Now system replicates the section of the virus's genetic material until there's enough for true detection. The new test drastically cuts down the waiting time for results, which can currently range from hours to days. Slow testing has been one of the biggest problems in the United States in response to the coronavirus pandemic. After a variety of missteps, which included problems with a test designed by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. regulators have rushed to approve commercial tests. Let me drop for a sec. This isn't the first rapid coronavirus test approved by the FDA this month. Recently, it also approved a test by molecular diagnostic company Cepheid, which can provide results in approximately 45 minutes. However, Cepheid's officials say that their test is meant to be used in hospitals or emergency rooms. In addition to its new 5-minute test recently, Abbott also received FDA emergency approval for another COVID-19 test that uses its M2000 real-time system. Unlike the point-of-care test, this test is run in hospitals and laboratories only. The system can process more tests daily, up to 1 million a week, according to Bloomberg, but it takes longer to get the results. Between both systems, Abbott expects to produce about 5 million COVID-19 tests per month. Well, let me drop for any questions or comments on this particular subject. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. A small trial from China may already throw into question whether a treatment touted as a way to save people with severe COVID-19 can really work. It found no evidence that the existing drug hydroxychloroquine alone was more effective for patients hospitalized with the novel coronavirus than standard care. However, the results aren't any more definitive than the earlier research that suggested the drug can work. Hydroxychloroquine and its close relative chloroquine are both existing drugs used to treat acute cases of infectious disease malaria, as well as certain autoimmune disorders like lupus. But scientists have long speculated that both drugs have a broad antiviral effect. Earlier research in the lab had specifically shown these drugs could kill the SARS virus, closely related to the new coronavirus known as SARS-CoV-2. Or COVID-19. Most recently, reports from the doctors in China and France treating severe COVID-19 patients reported success with using hydroxychloroquine, sometimes in combination with the antibiotic azithromycin. That's the one that I told you with the incredible flaws in it, by the way. Those reports prompted the president to praise these drugs, calling for them to be deployed immediately to hospitals across the United States. His own public health experts and outside researchers, however, have struck a much more cautious tone, rightly arguing that more rigorous testing is needed to test out any promising treatment for COVID-19 before it could be widely used. This past week, the World Health Organization announced that hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine would be among the drugs evaluated in a large, globe-spanning clinical trial of COVID-19 treatment. Let me drop for a sec. But given the early anecdotal success of these drugs, doctors have already started carrying out their own small, controlled, and uncontrolled clinical trials. This latest one, reported in the Journal of Jixing University, involved 30 patients in China that had been hospitalized with COVID-19. Half were given standard care, and the other half received hydroxychloroquine for 5 days alongside this care. The patients also had their throats routinely swabbed for the genetic presence of the virus, with a negative result indicating that the active infection had passed. By day 7, most people in either group had negative throat swabs, with no clear advantage seen for those on the hydroxychloroquine. There was also no significant difference in the amount of time it took patients in either group to stop having symptoms, such as high fever. One person's condition in the hydroxychloroquine group worsened severely, but all had improved by the end of the trial. The findings seem to be the first from a randomized and, importantly, controlled trial involving hydroxychloroquine, but the sample size is still very small. It also didn't test the combination of azithromycin, which researchers theorize can have an added anti-inflammatory effect and help treat severe COVID-19 cases where people are infected by bacteria along with the coronavirus. This study, in other words, is not a death knell for hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, but it may provide a clear lesson for why any experimental treatment shouldn't be hyped too early. Following Trump's proclamation, people in the United States, including doctors, are already rushing out to stockpile these drugs, which could affect their supply for patients who rely on them for their intended purposes. Tragically, one person has died after taking tablets containing the chloroquine that were originally intended to treat parasitic infestations in aquariums, while that person's wife remains in critical care. And we'll get to that story as well. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Does Abbott have anything to do with the antibody test that they're looking into? You know, the test where they test your blood and they can figure out whether or not you've had it. I understand that you know you could have this COVID-19 and not have any feeling whatsoever, no fever, nothing. But I mean, you know, you think about it. If that person could get tested, he would be able to go back to work because I think he would be immune. Is that the company, Abbott, or is that another company?
I think you're alluding to Abbott. A-B-B-O-T-T, I think is the way they spell it. That's a different test. There are two types of tests involved in COVID-19. Primarily for epidemiological reasons, they're kind of focusing on tests that are able to detect active viral particles, either in the mucus discharge or in the blood. What you're talking about is a different interesting method, which is to test whether people have developed antibodies, which means they've already fought off the infection, and now they have antibodies in their bloodstream that would fight against a reinfection. Those have been being worked on, and I believe Abbott Lab is working on serology tests such as that. And that'll add another layer of knowledge to the epidemiology of this situation.
Okay, that'll be good once they develop that. You can send all the, am I right? You'd be able to send these people out to work? I mean, they wouldn't be able to either infect anybody or get infected themselves.
Yeah, Paul. Theoretically, if you do the viral particle tests and they come out negative, you can pretty much pre-assume that the infection has ended and they're now in the immune stage. This is, again, early for this virus, so we can't definitively say that you could never get it again, but it seems at this point that the people who were infected, usually they can get better, a little better, and then a little worse. But usually if the symptoms and the viral shedding cease That's usually a good indication that at least over the short haul, you can't catch it again. So that's probably what's going to happen over time as more people are infected. And most people survive it very reasonably. Anywhere from 80 to 90% of people infected with the virus either have very, very mild symptoms or no symptoms. It's that 10 to 20% where you get real bad flu-like aches and pains, fevers, a great deal of fatigue, and among those, the small subgroup where secondary viral pneumonia occurs, where instead of just staying in the upper respiratory tract, it travels down the trachea and produces a diffuse and sudden acute respiratory syndrome that can require, at the very least, oxygen supplied by a mask and may require a respirator for as long as a week or two.
WA2VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
Yeah, Roy, since this is also the flu season, as they do these different tests, do they have a means of a differential diagnosis that it may be flu instead of COVID-19? Go ahead.
Yes, John. Matter of fact, one of the algorithms that some people use in testing people for the COVID virus is to first test them for strep throat, and if they're negative, test them for influenza. Influenza test is very similar to the technology involved in the viral shedding of the COVID-19. It's called a PCR. It replicates genetic material so that there's enough material to be tested, and you can see whether or not the person is shedding viruses. That's the reason why it takes so long. PCR requires multiple episodes of heating and cooling and heating and cooling for the different replications to take place, and builds up enough of a number to have an accurate result. But sort of the same test is used in influenza as well. So a lot of times you'll test, the person will come in with flu-like symptoms and fever. You'll test them for strep throat. You'll test them for influenza. And if they fail both, you move on to the COVID-19. As time goes on and COVID-19 tests are more readily available, people are using less of that algorithm, depending upon the clinical picture. Influenza season kind of peaked about a month or two ago, so it's going down. A matter of fact, there are some websites that have temperatures of, you know, they sell these little cell phone attached type of apps, temperature takers, and they download all that data and they feed it into a map, and you can sort of see the fever curve from influenza as it's going down. And they've demonstrated in different areas like Florida and New York where all of a sudden it's going down in a nice, smooth way, and it makes a bump. And that bump, unfortunately, is the atypical fevers that were due to the COVID-19.
I see. Very good. Okay. Thanks, Roy.
Any other questions before I move on to the story of a guy who tried to treat himself?
JD2NVV with a question.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, good evening, Roy, and everybody on the net. Yeah, you were talking about eliminating flu and strep throat and before you test the person for COVID. But wouldn't it be possible, well, let me ask you, is it possible to have, like, flu and COVID at the same time or strep throat? You know, like, it wouldn't necessarily eliminate the COVID-19 just because you had the flu. But back to you, Roy.
Well, I mean, theoretically, yes, it's possible, but highly unlikely. They don't usually travel together, so you'll get one or the other, but you'll seldom get both.
EC2IS coming.
Yes, Bill.
don't remember where, but there are doctors in the UK reporting that people test positive for influenza and for COVID-19.